Rosario Hernandez Catalan. Picture this, a ball machine throwing tennis balls. Bam, 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 bam. Now substitute each tennis ball with little balls of pain. Bam, 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 bam. Now take the machine and imagine it's a pussy. It smells bad, it's dirty, humid, it gets infected time and time again. This is perhaps one of the greatest strengths the patriarchal matrix wields, turning our pussies into machines that birth physical and psychological pain. This is, after all, the patriarchy's towering achievement, having turned the center of the matrix, our bodies, into a hell that's humid, sinister, and full of suffering. It is this very same cancerous, dangerous, down-there region that is the nexus of fear for so many women, who are scared of it because of what the medical establishment tells them to fear. It hurts us because the patriarchy wants it to be so, because it's right and proper. The magnum opus of this factory is this machine that pops out soldiers, citizens, voters, consumers, spectators. This machine creates a morality of slaves and masters. Casilda Rodriguez has warned us of this before, and well, it took a millennia for it to come to be. It took centuries upon centuries for the patriarchy to settle itself over this planet. This isn't something, after all, that happens from one night to the next. No, it requires a great deal of investment and social engineering over a very long period of time. I nevertheless hope and demand it takes the few free men and women left a bit less time to correct the situation. Leaving aside the energies emanating from the earth, which we can put into the matter box, the energy emanating from logs, water, fossils, and other minerals from the guts of the earth, the energy that the supreme powerholic needs to control in order to reach our present mess is that of human labor. You don't have to be a full-fledged Marxist to understand this. From the great perversion of slave work, which has always laid the foundations of every empire, to the great perversion of wage labor, oh money, money, deceitfully interiorized, in the depths of her and our psyche lies a little tyrant shaped like a clock. Oh, the blessed clock, unifier of nations, and truly another machine exerting control over bodies and souls. And this energy called, who produces it? Who could it be but the bodies and psyches of those animals called human beings? And who produces those beings so efficient and laborious? Women, feminized and turned to garbage. Therefore, in order to control the matter of Gaia, it is necessary to control the female, precisely because of the great utility of those uteri that make human beings, which in turn generate the labor energy. And it's at that point that patriarchy and state capitalism sign their marriage until death do them apart. Tightly bonded, like the double helix of our DNAs, like two locks from the same fried and freshly permed curl. It is crucial to understand what they've done to motherhood as an institution, what they've done to biology, how they've fucked our physiology one mass at a time with their inquisitions, fears, and bio-capitalist iatrogenesis. What have they done to our pussies so full of pain today, but so full of pleasure yesterday and tomorrow? The question of motherhood, of pussies and uteri, is not a footnote to history and biology. It is there that we mould freed or enslaved future beings. And here lies the reason why uterus control is the central source of domination of this piece of shit, all this shit I've been calling the Patrix. It's but a curl made of three locks which are too much of a muchness. Patriarchy, capitalism, and state, with all racism, sexism, and speciesisms.
Orgasmische Geburt.
Ecstatic birth is also known as orgasmic birth, but here I will use the term ecstatic instead. The point is not whether you reach orgasm or not, just like in any other sexual relationship, but whether the experience is satisfactory as a whole. There is a great deal of prejudice towards this kind of childbirth, to such an extent that many women who have experienced it still keep it a secret. It is more frequent than it seems, and it has always existed. Ecstatic birth should be another stage of motherhood, a sexual stage, alongside the sexual pleasures of pregnancy and breastfeeding. I like to think that there was a time when we always used to give birth with pleasure, before the biblical and patriarchal curse fell upon us.
Nuria M. Martin. I believe in bodies. I don't give a single solitary fuck about culture, intellectuals, science, or knowledge. I believe in nature, in our wildness, and in the strength of our instincts. My body seeks pleasure. Sometimes it finds pleasure in pain, because pain is an intense and powerful emotion that has the power to heal. My body is wise. My brain is just another organ that tries to explain the world to me through theories and labels and other constructions. I feel that motherhood is one of many sexual stages our bodies go through. I felt this in my own body, even before being a biological mother. I don't think it's a mere chance that babies gestate inside the uterus, the same uterus that moves when we get excited and have an orgasm. Ecstatic births are a fact of life. Sari Wild. I'm very happy with my sexuality. I see it as the fruit of my personal trajectory, getting rid of my guilt, carrying out my desires, feeling that I control each and every situation. Everything that happens does so because I choose it. I'm very curious and I like to read a bit of everything, but I didn't read about this. This came to me from somewhere else. It's been one of the few things that's purely been experience and vitality. I read about it afterwards and then had names for every experience. It really is a matter of life experience and about people being willing to accept that experience and the fact that not all of us have to experience an orgasmic birth. Imagine what pressure that must be.
Soziale Realitäten. Maria Lopez.
Our capitalist and patriarchal society is already deranged, but it's when you have to raise children that you're really in for the VIP treatment. You don't work at all, they ask you, and all the while you have been raising children, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, sleepless nights included. When facing a question such as these, I, for one, go mad. The indignation that such questions create in me is fathomless.
Alicia Murillo. I'm against policies that encourage a compulsory 50-50 split in responsibility, as is the case with non-transferable maternity leave, for instance, since every family is different. There will be families that want to give 100% of the parenting duties to her, others where they wish to give 100% to him, and even more who want it to be distributed unequally between multiple parties. Or maybe some want to split it between two men or two women, because these kinds of policies often have a very deep heterosexual heritage behind them. It is assumed that every couple is heterosexual, and those which aren't are pushed to reproduce the abusive power dynamics of heterosexuality. Not every couple is willing to rear their children with a 50% share. What if they aren't even a couple? What if they are polyamory groups? And even if they are a man and woman, what if they'd rather organize themselves differently? During the High Middle Ages, women experienced a greater degree of freedom. I start before the church began to bureaucratize the totality of people's lives from birth, with the baptismal rite, through marriage and death. It's a fact that the greater the level of bureaucratization, the greater the control one has over people's lives, and particularly over the lives of women. From the moment the church takes hold of the social order, women's lives change radically. Up until the first instances of ecclesiastical bureaucratization, unions between people didn't necessarily stem from monogamy, and marriage as we know it didn't exist. Women had different partners throughout the different stages of their lives. Relationships weren't monopolized by marriage. What happened then? Well, women's economic relationships were different, and there was considerable female mercantile activity. Women were dedicated, among other things, to healing and tending to childbirths. This was an exclusively female line of work. Women would work in all those things laid out for women, from curing a stomachache to healing an infection, breastfeeding or parenting. I'm certain men were much more involved in parenting than now. A campaign of stigmatization, prosecution, and crime began to target women who cured diseases. There, the idea that women who healed were also evil appeared for the first time. Prostitution was the main pitfall of Christianity, and they fixed it with a stigmatizing ultimatum. Either they marry and do it for free, or they charge for it and become pariahs because they're women who earn money doing a job we men can't do. What this means for us in the 20th century and now is that we have had to become men in order to get a salary. We do the same jobs men can do, but with an entirely erroneous interpretation of the masculine outlook. That shouldn't be the way. We are working as much as them. 70% of medical professionals are women, but we take care and treat our patients like men do. I don't call that female medicine. Understanding female not as a biological identity, but as the state that subverts masculine oppression. Thank you. coitus is at the core of the sexual control imposed on women's bodies and their health. In coitus, you're exposed to a lot of sexual diseases that you wouldn't be exposed to if you didn't do it. You're exposed to unwanted pregnancies too. There's no nervous endings anywhere else but at the base of the vagina, the lower part of the clitoris. What you're touching in the act of coitus is the clitoris, not the vagina. It is true that a woman can have an orgasm without being touched, just by fantasizing, but that's different. I take coitus to be a submissive and sadomasochist practice. Coitus was established as a standard sexual practice, as the average one, and as the only one validated by patriarchy and the church, as a form of control. The idea is that if you haven't practiced coitus, you haven't practiced sex. This doesn't happen by chance. It leads to a total control of women's lives, and that's the main issue we face.
Geschlechter. Maria Lopez.
Is it a girl or a boy? How about neither? Let's give our children the option of choosing their gender, regardless of what they have between their legs. Our goal throughout all of our parenting should be to transcend the limits created by the assignation of gender. That is, queer theory as applied to parenting, or genderqueer parenting. There are people with uteri, there are women with no uteri, and there are men with them. One must distinguish between biology and social constructions of gender. Trans motherhood, fatherhood, is just one more option among many, part of a series of words that outline infinite realities. Despite believing in the universality of motherhood as a concept, in this case, we prefer to use the word fatherhood. Eric Huma is a trans person who carried his daughter in his uterus. Eric began the process of his gender transition when he was 19 years old. Yet, as he puts it, it's a very long process that never really ends. He became a father at 27.
Eric Huma. I'm relatively comfortable with the name Dad and with fatherhood, and Zoe recognizes me as such anyway. Sometimes when someone asks me where Zoe's mum is, I reply that I am her mother and father. There's loads of trans people who have kids. I have a good friend called Esther who had a kid that grew in his uterus. He's French and he's living in Bolivia now. On the other hand, I'd like to say that we shouldn't give that much importance to the expression of gender. If we were allowed to experiment, we would do it a lot more. But we're not allowed. We all have different gender expressions. Del La Grace Volcano. I never felt pressured to be a mother or father. Why is that? Maybe because I'm fucking queer. Of course, I am a proud mapper now. I'm a person that is intersex, intergender, queer, genderqueer, and trans. All of those labels apply to me, and they are really important. Mika has gone to daycare since he was a year old. It's a very good daycare that focuses on letting the kids be outdoors. They do everything outside, even nap, and they're less sick as a result. They're also great with everything relating to gender, and they use gender-neutral words like children instead of girls and boys. One day I was picking Mika up from daycare, and I heard some kids say, "Oh, here comes Mika's dad." I tried to explain to this child in my terrible Swedish that I was Mika's mappa, both male and female together, and I could tell the child was confused. So I talked to the caregiver and said that I didn't want the kids telling Mika that I'm his papa and not his mappa. The caregiver suggested I write a letter in both Swedish and English stating that I'm intersex and queer. It was very important to me because I didn't just want the kids to go home to their parents saying, "Oh, Mika has a mappa," and for them to be told it's wrong. I wanted the parents to say, "Oh yeah, that's a person that's both male and female. It doesn't happen that often, but it's fine." It worked pretty well. Now, when they read stories to them at the daycare, they include all kinds of rainbow families and mappas.
Co-Elternschaft. Maria Lopez.
The family unit, consisting of one or more children plus a biological father or mother, is a very recent invention that has little to do with a functional organization of parenting. In fact, it is a system that causes many problems. In other societies, the notion of uncle or father is closely linked, and men function as fathers of the children of their sisters, with whom they have a certified blood relation. There are multiple societies which don't bestow such a centrality to the notion of biological fatherhood. If we want to step outside of the imposed idea of a heteronormative sexual couple, we must logically come up with a different type of family unit. Co-parenting is an option that more and more people opt for.
Mad Kate. Many queers do that. They choose their own family, i.e. groups of people we live and have community with who are like chosen brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers. But also we have the power to choose parenthood outside of our sexual relationships. I was thinking about how to choose who I wanted to parent with and how it's not just dependent upon whom I'm having sex with. And I thought of Sadie right away. I really thought both Sadie and I were like-minded in terms of values. And then about 2 weeks after that dream, I was talking on the phone with Sadie, and she told me she was pregnant. So for me, from my perspective, it was a kind of alignment, a star alignment. That dream, Sadie being pregnant, and my partner, his girlfriend, being pregnant, it all came at the same time. And I thought, well, all these babies are coming my way, so the thing to do is probably to figure out how to be part of it instead of trying to get away from it. And so I asked Sadie to be a co-parent, a dad, and she said, "Great, I've been looking for people to co-parent with me." When I made the decision to co-parent, it was and is a lifelong decision. I committed myself. And it's the same for Sadie, obviously. So I said to myself, at least I feel committed to my relationship with Lorca, my daughter, in whatever capacity. That, for me, is important. There's been a lot of challenges along the way. Especially, I think, a lot of tension and pressure has come into my relationship with Sadie, because I think it's just not that easy to decide to co-parent. There are a lot of things that are really great about the fact that there is not a sexual or romantic relationship between us. I think there are some great things about that, but there are also difficulties about that. We are a queer family. We are two genderqueer women and a trans man. And all three wanted to be in the birth. Not just two queer people, but three. I think that between the three of us, it was not really enough. Over time, we found other people that could come in, and that was super helpful. Maybe because of the combination of not being in a romantic relationship with Sadie, and also not being the biological father, the distance exists. I wanted to be a parent and I wanted to have a relationship with Lorca, but I can't say that I have the same perspective or relationship that the birth mother does.
Stillen. Maria Lopez.
I want to reclaim alternative, non-patriarchal structures for motherhood and parenting. I want to create patterns and molds that are distinct from the single model imposed on us. Co-breastfeeding is comfortable and practical. It can ease the already difficult process of raising children. Despite all this, we still live in a society that promotes a monogamy of the breast. It's better to extract milk with hurtful and expensive machines that allow your baby to feed on the milk from another mother. It is better to give them artificial and also expensive formula in a bottle than to take part in something as straightforward, easy, and anti-capitalist as taking out your breast and sharing.
Barbara Iserte. I think there should be a bank, but not a bank full of milk. A bank full of people who can mobilise themselves. A list of mothers, just like there are a list of apartments to rent. Maybe a phone application would be a good idea. Each person who wants to offer themselves to breastfeed in a specific zone at a specific time could say so on their profile. And the people who need it could just contact her. There could be various breastfeeding groups and circles that could help out. One just needs to sign up and join this network.
Frauenheilkunde.
Pabla Perez. Our views of healthcare are fundamentally made in the image of men. We speculate and diagnose from a point of view established by men, and as a result are mistreated, manipulated, and disrespected in all of our sexual processes. I'm an investigator researching the use of medicinal herbs in women's sexual health. At the same time, I continuously grow and learn as a mother and a midwife. My investigative work takes place within the frame of my project named Gynecosophia. The focus is on rescuing the most ancient wisdom from our grandmothers and on awakening the power of self-knowledge based on our shared ancestral memory in order to benefit female sexuality and health. Bringing a child into the world is a fantastic process when it's lived out in a conscious, desired, full of love and contained way. Throughout the period of gestation, all of our physical and spiritual existence prepares itself to welcome this new component. The placenta, naturally, takes care of all the baby's necessities while the uterus sustains it within its nest. The woman's body is the crib that takes in all the vibrations and movements of the being we treasure inside. We transform together, growing step by step until the moment of maturity. Then we both give birth. The child gives birth to us too, certainly. The body of the woman, her sexuality, and the sensations she feels, it all changes. It's truly a metamorphosis. I think mothers have a lot left to say about what happens to us. We tend to hide ourselves and not explain ourselves as much as we need to. Likewise, we also see that we lack spaces and ways. We're lacking spaces and resources, something which leaves us out of the feminist movement, because naturally the feminist struggle is more focused on the depenalization of abortion than on a comprehensive dialogue between all the artists and vast sexualities we represent. It's a crucial struggle which sometimes, oddly, gets in the way and is set up against elective motherhood when it shouldn't be that way. These two sides of the struggle should complement each other as necessary and paralleled rights, full of political perspectives and gaps that we must all resolve together. Clow kinky. Reproduction and motherhood are not for me. My line of research tends towards contraception, abortion, techniques of menstrual extractions, etc. This is alongside my attempts to recover the veiled historical memory surrounding the fields of obstetrics, gynecology, and urogynecology. I consider them to be completely complementary fields of knowledge. Gynepunk is about getting involved in a radical change in how we understand medical technologies and the so-called professional medical institutions. Gynepunk is an extreme and rigorous gesture to unplug our bodies from its compulsive dependence on the fossilized machine structures of our hegemonic health system. The aim of gynepunk is to make DIY, DIT, do it yourself, do it together, laboratories, and diagnosis techniques visible in experimental spaces, under rocks or in elevators if need be. It's about having these labs and their manifold possibilities anywhere, in a stable place and in nomad laboratories, so we can conduct cytologies, fluid analysis, PAPs, hormone synthesis, blood, urine tests, HIV tests, pain relief, or whatever, whenever we need to do so. It's about hacking and constructing our own ultrasound devices, endoscopies or sonographies, low cost. This whole experimentation is done hand in hand with a deep knowledge about medicinal herbs, oral traditions, and underground recipes, and is led by an unquenchable quest to generate an array of DIY lubes, contraceptive methods, open domains for doulas, savage care work such as menstrual extraction with the use of visceral and crafted technologies. We want to bring everything to its maximum potential by sharing knowledge and radically empowering our bodies. Gynepunk is based on scientific methodologies and disciplines, and it springs both from the knowledge extracted from each body's self-experience and from our ancestral bodily wisdom. Yet another example of how crucial memory and archive is in any given format. Visual treasures, sound minds, microscopic riddles, biological showcases, centers of biological growth, online seed banks, archives of fluids, fanzines, choruses of oral decoding, voodoo self-healing rituals. Gynepunk will ferment and mutate alongside all of this, initiating an expansive and explosive movement in the direction of radical experiments and strong collective trust in our body politic. It's crucial to share these ideas and make them viral through an infinite pandemonium. No one can burn us. No one. The witches have the flames now in their hands.
Matriarchal. Maria Lopez.
Once upon a time, there was a matriarchal society that worshipped nature and motherhood above all else. It was a nomadic society, and as such, it gradually began to find itself pushed towards agriculture and the domestication of animals in order to better face the changing environmental landscape. The new forms of social organization forced this once matriarchal society to become the patriarchal society we live in today, and saw the imposition of concepts like private property, inheritance, marriage, and the binding of female sexuality within these structures. This last feature cemented the centrality of biological fatherhood, which up to this moment has been considered secondary, given that children were raised abundantly communally. The ideas of motherhood underpinning this patriarchal and capitalist setup are those of a disempowered motherhood. the patriarchal and libidinally aseptic mother. Since that moment, our uteri lost the capacity for pleasure. Pain defines our menstruation, childbirth, and even how we raise our children. But our bodies are precisely made to enjoy each one of these stages. Subverting this spiral of pain consists fundamentally in reconnecting ourselves with our creative and life-giving capacities, those forces that were so the core of the early matriarchal societies. Motherhood is truly a sexual stage, and here I ask to be allowed to become mystical and somewhat tantric for a moment. This blissful sexuality supposes the existence of transcendental and profound connection with nature and the universe. Subversive motherhood is blissful sexuality. It is transfeminist, ecological, ecosexual, spiritual, magical, healing.
Jesusa Recoe Olariaga. Whenever I was asked to describe what I was doing, I would get into all kinds of long, convoluted rants. It occurred to me to summarise it all up with the term matriactivism, since my work as an activist consists of pushing for change on matriarchal issues that currently stand outside the physiological reality of the system we live in. In a culture built on masculine power, it's central to debunk maternal power. The issue here, perhaps, is precisely the disproportionate importance we give to power, but that's another debate. I think obstetric violence is the product of a specific outlook. It's based on the physical ignorance of those who haven't experienced it and understood it in pathological terms, which consequently requires the disempowerment of women in order to control the processes that rule their bodies. Obviously, there are midwives and obstetricians who are women and mothers, but the basic questions and the general approach which is still followed today was created with a patriarchal mindset in an age where women had very little space to state their opinions. Something as simple as the lithotomy position, a woman lying facing upwards with her legs on supports, is deeply illustrative of this point. That posture is established by an observer who feels himself or herself to be in a position of authority, thus facing the medical event without the least bit of physiological empathy. I tend to feel somewhat uncomfortable when dealing with issues of spirituality, since I'm a very pragmatic person, and I think we often trivialise these topics. Unfortunately, the quest for matriarchality tends to bring in its wake an assortment of new agey charlatans selling a reinvented religious packaging filled with all kinds of odds and ends which leave me utterly slack-jawed. To summarise, our understanding and expression of the world lacks so many voices, sexes, and colours. Our society is utterly unhinged on these points, and consequently on all fronts. I also think that there's been a supremacy of the intellect over the animal and instinctive. We haven't learnt how to use them both in order to nourish the other in a reciprocal manner. We understand our instincts as precarious and regressive, when they actually dictate a large part of our daily interactions. We are animals, no matter how much varnish we spread all over us. Women, when they understand themselves physiologically, are closer to that instinctive part of themselves than men, because they are bound to know themselves as mammals, and so understand themselves beyond culture. This is what ought to make us reflect and realize that this need to fashion ourselves as scientific and intellectual beings is incompatible with our identification as mammals, as primates, and, however intelligent, as animals. I think that an integration of matriarchality and instinct in our way of understanding ourselves would be one of the most enriching steps taken in our evolution as human beings.
Eco-sex.
Annie Sprinkle and Beth Stevens. The goal is to recover the lost connection between sexuality and ecology. This buried connection is something I consider fundamental to motherhood as a subversive act, given that it offers up a much more complex and encompassing vision of sexuality. There are lots of stages within the world of sexuality, and in order to live out maternity and parenting in the most complete way, one must work to understand and enjoy them. Most people imagine the Earth as a mother, because it feeds us, it takes care of us, but we feel like the mother is in menopause, and now she's tired and she's taken care of us for so long, and we are shitting on it, literally, in a bad way, not in a good way, so the Earth needs more love. So our activist strategy is to imagine the Earth as a lover, so maybe people would treat it better. Just like how with some lovers there are relationships that are truly reciprocal and egalitarian, we think the Earth needs to feel what it gives is reciprocated, to be told nice things and made love to. We're trying to create a more equal relationship with the Earth as lovers. However, the Earth is still also mother for us, and also father. It's queer. Eco-sex can just simply be an exchange of sensual energy, like smelling, touching, tasting, seeing. It's really just seeing sexuality and sensuality in everything that surrounds you, all the time. That's what we feel and define as eco-sex. Life force energy is sexual energy. When a rose bush explodes into roses, those are its genitals we see. When we smell the roses, we're smelling its reproductive parts, its pussy and sperm. If you have an ecosexual gaze, you see sex everywhere. It's not necessarily genital, but essential energy too.